You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, Executive Vice President of the James Beard Foundation. And every Wednesday morning at 11 o'clock, we have a conversation about my favorite subject. I hope it's yours, and that's taste. And today, we're doubly excited to have a conversation, not just about taste, really, but about the importance of our food, not for pleasure, although pleasure is certainly part of it, but because we are conscientious citizens living in an interesting time where food is everywhere and where food problems are beginning to surface in places we didn't expect them and in some places where others have been telling us they'll be coming for a long time. One of those people who has been telling us a lot about the politics of food and anticipating some of the things perhaps that we might not have anticipated when we had a lovely meal ourselves, or in fact, what some people digesting for us, what some people have been saying all along and helping us to understand the issues about our food and how it's produced and where it comes from and what its effect is on our health, is Marion Nessel. She needs no introduction, but I will introduce her as not just a mentor of mine and a person of whom I'm proud to be able to share a meal every once in a while and a fascinating conversation and even perhaps a Tai Chi set now and then. We can talk about that maybe at the end or on a different show. But who is a professor at NYU, author of the Food Politics, which is a great book about to celebrate a big anniversary with a new edition. But we're talking today about a new book, an unusual project for Marion, I think, called Eat, Drink, Vote, which is really a collection of cartoons. Marion, thank you for coming to the show. Thank you for letting us in your office to tape the show, I should say. We came to you today. It's really a pleasure to have you here and a pleasure to be talking about cartoons of all things.
Yeah, isn't it fun? This is the launch day of the book, and here it is in gorgeous full color. And it was the best fun I ever had doing a book.
I've seen you present always, and you always use cartoons because they can say so much so quickly, I think. And here you've collected some really interesting cartoons about food. They were not made for you for this book, but you gathered them from thousands, I imagine, out there, and put them together to tell the story of what the issues are facing our food system today. What was behind this project?
Well, I just thought it would be fun. I had just finished writing Why Calories Count with Mal Nesheim, and it was a very hard book to write. It involved a lot of science, and because a lot of it was very controversial, it involved very careful review of the science and a lot of really deep digging to make sure that we had the facts right and that our interpretation of the facts could hold up to scrutiny and that sort of thing. And by the time I finished with it, I just wanted to do something that was fun. And in the course of doing that book, which had a few cartoons in it, I had to get permission to use the cartoons. You're not allowed to just take cartoons and
The nerve.
There's intellectual property rights that you have to deal with, and getting permission to use cartoons is often very, very difficult. And two of them came from something called the Cartoon Group, which I'd never heard of. It was this group in Seattle that represents a lot of cartoonists, about 50 cartoonists. And in the course of dealing with Sarah Thaves, who owns that group and runs it, in the middle of our conversation about how much money she was going to charge me for this, she said, are you the Marion Nessel who wrote Food Politics? And I said, guilty as charged. And she said, you know, I've always wanted to do a book using our cartoons about food politics. And I said, gee, that's funny. I have too.
Oh my gosh.
And there it was. And I said, the big problem with doing a book like that is the permissions and the amount of money that you have to pay. I couldn't possibly do what I wanted to. And she said, well, why don't we collaborate on something and I'll take care of the permissions. And so that's what we have, is a 50-50 collaboration on this book in which she provided the cartoons and I provided the text. And she gave me 1,100 cartoons to choose from.
Wow. That's amazing.
So that was the cartoonist group has the most fabulous search engine. That's all I can say. You can go on to their website and say, I want a cartoon about anything you could possibly think of, and up they pop. It's really, really well done. And so she must have searched their database for everything about food, politics, and whatever other search word she used. And she just kept sending them to me in these enormous batches. And I had my entire living room with piles of cartoons trying to sort them out in one topic or another. And eventually I sorted them out into 11 piles. And that's the 11 chapters of this book.
As someone who has written and will continue to write serious books with lots of words, what do the cartoons contribute besides the humor in the conversation? I'm sure you're not going to let down your standards of accuracy get in the way, even if it's fun. I mean, you have your reputation at stake. What do they add to the conversation, to the book?
Well, they make people listen, for one thing.
Oh,
I mean, people laugh. It just completely changes the tone of the interaction. I mean, I've used cartoons in my presentations for years and have vast collections of them. I wish I could do something with that collection, too. But I can't, because it's impossible because of the permission problem. I can show a cartoon, and some of my favorites are in the introductory chapter to the book. The one about the pyramid, for example, I didn't know it came from the cartoonist group. I've given it in every talk I've ever given about the pyramid. Not that one, but the...
We're flipping through the colored
pages. Flipping that one.
There we go.
That one. That cartoon, which came out in 2005 when the USDA's pyramid was revised from something that had food on it to something that didn't have any food on it at all, and had this funny guy running up the side of it that Clark Wolf said was some gay guy, and the rainbow colors. The most ridiculous thing. And the I could go spend a great deal of time writing, and I did in the new edition of Food Politics, about what's wrong with this pyramid. But here you can do it in one...
In caption, one, in one line, which says, I'm confused. Does level red mean severe risk of terrorist attacks or eat more fruit?
I show that. Everybody roars. It's hilariously funny in that context. And the... And it just makes the audience more comfortable about listening. Oh, I'm not going to be lectured. I'm not going to be told what to eat. This isn't a food police experience. This is going to be something that's fun and interesting. And so I'm hoping that this book might reach a larger audience than is willing to sit down with Food Politics or even What to Eat or any of the other books that I've written. And kind of, maybe they'll read the text. I suspect that people will only look at the cartoons.
Right.
But the text is very short, but it's referenced.
Yes, and I would encourage people to read it, because in a short time, because of the illustration of the cartoons, which I think you use to present sometimes other or opposing views on some of the more difficult issues, as well as just to make fun of some of the conundrums that any political, any social, political, anything has, really, really feel like you get a... It's very satisfying. When you're finished reading it, you feel like you have a substantial overview of the whole picture. And maybe you want more, and then you would go pick up one of your other books, let's say, the Food Politics. What has changed? I mean, there's 11 chapters in the buckets. What are the pieces you think that has changed since you've been studying? I mean, you study the food system from a high level in some ways, what's going on across many different levels, whether it's nutrition, whether it's food policy, whether it's public health and behavior issues. What do you feel has changed, or where the emphases have changed, where we've made progress or where we haven't, or what you think needs to happen?
The big change is the food movement.
Okay.
I mean, it's the enormous change.
And what does that mean?
Well, it means the vast number of people who are interested in these issues and want to change the food system from industrialized, mm-hmm. heavily marketed junk food to something that's cleaner, fairer, and healthier for people on the planet. Mm-hmm. And that is such a profound change. And you know, I would like to think that food politics had something to do with it, that it means that you're talking to a very different audience. I mean, also, it's young people. Mm-hmm. So it's the big proponents of libertarianism, and many of these cartoonists are libertarians. Mm-hmm. Some of the ones whose work I admire the most, because they can do something in just a couple of lines that takes your breath away. Mm-hmm. I mean, really, some of these people are fabulous artists, in addition to being quite clever. Right. You know, you look at the cartoons and you think, well, these people have very, very different kinds of opinions, and they're really hard on personal responsibility. The mm-hmm. government has nothing to do with food choice. This is a matter of personal responsibility. I want the government out of what I'm doing. And what I tried to do in this book was to recognize those as serious ways of looking at these things, because I confront them all the time.
Right. They exist.
They exist. They're there. But also to get my own view of what those issues are in there in a way that's short and to the point and not very mm-hmm. heavy-handed, and to try to explain where the flaws are in those kinds of argument. I mean, the government is already involved in food choice, so getting it involved in food choice in a different way wouldn't really mm-hmm. change things. It would just... It's a slight tweaking. It's mm-hmm. not a major philosophical difference. But I think a lot of people don't recognize that. So the cartoons allowed me to do, I call this book Food Politics Light, L-I-T-E, light.
Right.
The book allowed me to talk about issues in food politics and a lot of very current issues in a way that wasn't heavy-handed, that I hope wasn't heavy-handed, and that didn't keep people over the head, and that was respectful of the of other people's ways of looking at these kinds of issues, in a way that was, in many cases, some of the cartoons are funny, some of them are not funny at all.
some of them are sad, in fact. I mean, the realities are complicated, especially when it comes to food and I mean, you don't leave anything out. Radioactivity and fish from Japan, oil and Gulf seafood. I mean, there are a lot of difficult, these aren't even issues about the food system, but they are consequences of some of the choices we've made and the way that we do things. And it's all in here, and you do laugh.
Yeah. And I let the cartoons guide the book. Mm. So I had my piles of cartoons, and you know, I sort of did a triage. I turned in a manuscript with 400 cartoons because I could not choose between them.
And how many ended up in the final book?
250. and we had a triage meeting, the editor and and some of the other people at Rodale Books, and did the triaging. It was really difficult. And then there were other changes made for design reasons or color reasons or whether things fit or not. But you just passed one cartoon that I put in. I loved the cartoon so much that I wrote about it. It was a Libya cartoon, even though I couldn't even remember what the Libyan thing was about, that. I just loved that cartoon. And so some of them are in there because I loved them.
And so let's describe. We're looking at missiles shaped like Wonder Bread with the logo on the front, and it says the latest attempt to neutralize North Korea's nuclear threat is to send them missiles of Wonder Bread. I mean, we could use that in Syria, maybe. Yeah, it might be helpful.
Yeah, well, here, there's another cartoon. Oh, here's the cartoon where it says Libya, but I wish that I want to just cross it out and put Syria there.
Right, and the caption is, the world can't stand by and watch innocent people die. So they're, well... It's hard to describe. Page 32, you have to buy the book. Maybe we'll put it on the website. So let's get back to this question of the food movement, because it's a term that we hear, what is the food movement moving towards? I mean, in some ways, you know, if we talk about the civil rights movement, it's a little bit easier to categorize. But one of the things increasingly in our conversations at the Beard Foundation with chefs or other people interested in food system change is it's hard to get them to agree what we're changing toward or what we're looking to. So what is this a movement to?
Yeah. Well, I would say in very broad terms that it's a movement towards a food system that's healthier for people and the planet. Mm-hmm. That's kind of my summary of it. It's different from classic social movements. I've taught courses in social movements, and it's different from those in that it's not the women's movement or the environmental movement or the civil rights movement. in that it doesn't have a very clear, discrete goal, although there was plenty of dispute in all three of those movements about what the final goals were, too. And it's made up of, I think by this time, thousands of small groups that are working on one or another issue, and there are hundreds of issues that food movement people are working on. That's why the mayor's forum that I spoke at, or that I moderated a few weeks ago, was so impressive to me, because 80 of these groups had gotten together and decided on the questions that they wanted to ask the mayoral candidates, and they had actually gotten common questions that all
across
of the
groups.
Across the groups, well, across the 12 of the biggest groups anyway. And that's, in my estimation, a first. Mm-hmm. Other than there was a community food security coalition in California that has subsequently broke up, that was hundreds of organizations working on food security issues. But that's just one issue.
We're going to come back to that mayoral meeting, because I think it's an interesting touch point, turning point, in the movement. But first, we're going to take a quick break. We're talking with Mary Nessel, author most recently of Eat, Drink, Vote, An Illustrated Guide to Food Politics. You're listening to Taste Matters on Heritage Radio Network.
Brooklyn Slate Company is a collaborative effort from Brooklyn graphic designer Sean Tice and Parsons graduate student Christy Hedeka. After visiting Christy's family slate quarry in upstate New York in the spring of 2009, the two grabbed a few pieces for use as all-purpose boards back home in Brooklyn. They found a number of purposes for the slate and began gifting pieces to friends. The response was so overwhelmingly positive that the two struck out to produce a line of slate products. They now make regular trips to the family quarry in upstate New York to hand-pick their favorite pieces of black and red slate. Some of the slate is sourced from the quarry graveyard, a collection of odd-shaped pieces that were ultimately destined to be ground for use as road cover or baseball diamonds. They then transport the pieces to their studio in Red Hook, Brooklyn, where they do additional cutting and clean the stone to be food slate. Every single piece of packaging that comes with their products, from the envelope to the burlap bag, can be repurposed for other uses. The end result is a product completely unique in cut, shape, color, and overall presentation. For more information and to order, visit brooklynslate.com.
Welcome back to Taste Matters. I'm Mitchell Davis, your host, and I'm talking with Marion Nessel, and we're talking about lots of things. It's always an interesting conversation with Marion. Most recently, she's released Eat, Drink, Vote, An Illustrated Guide to Food Politics, which is a compendium of 11 chapters about different aspects of the food system, illustrated with really funny editorial cartoons about all sorts of things, from how we should deal with North Korea to whose business is it anyway, how large our sodas are. And we were talking before you left, actually, speaking of sodas, you moderated a panel of the mayoral candidates in New York City. We are in an election year, and food, you put food front and center, representing a coalition of more than 80 groups interested in what the next mayor of New York City will do about issues related to food. Tell us why you think that's a historic gathering again. Let's go back to that.
Well, it has to do with the food movement dispersion and the fact that it's not a unified movement, but one that deals with many, 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 many issues, and there are thousands, literally thousands of groups working on these issues. And the issues range from urban gardening to food insecurity to doing something about the farm bill. I mean, you could just go on and on and on. There are so many of them. And one of the issues about the movement that Michael Pollan has been very forceful about writing on is that if you want real political power, you have to bring these groups together so the voices are loud enough and unified enough to be able to get real political action. And there hasn't been very much sign of that among these groups. And there are reasons for that. I get students to talk about these things all the time. And the reasons have to do with the fact that these groups are developed by very passionate, involved people who take ownership of that particular group and recruit other people to it and raise money for it and act with it and have very tiny amounts of political power within their own groups. Very, very difficult for them to give that up to a larger entity. And so I was blown away that these 12 groups that were sponsoring this this session had worked for a year to try to do coalition building, recognizing the need to get real political power, and they were strong enough to get 6 candidates to agree to come and answer the questions that they had developed. I was very impressed by that, and apparently they're still working. Mm.
And were you impressed by the answers, or did you learn anything about? I mean, obviously, we're talking politics and campaigning, which is different from politics and actually doing. But I mean, what did you hear?
Well, I didn't hear anything actually.
Okay.
I heard nothing. I was so worried about the timing, and there were runners and signs being held up. I mean, there was just so much going on that I had to pay attention to, and then there was the 15-minute gap that I had to fill. Required a lot of rising to the occasion. I didn't hear much about what they said, except it sounded like platitudes.
Right.
I was much more impressed with the public health page in the Times yesterday, where they asked the candidates 3 questions about public health, one of which was about the soda cap. And that was interesting. I mean, there they were forced to say in writing. Also, the Anthony Weiner thing had just broken, and there was all
right,
that stuff.
I
mean,
right.
It was, I was there in a sense, but not there
so
in another.
Let me rephrase the question then. If you had 30 minutes with the next mayor of New York City, what would you tell him or her that he or she ought to do? What do you think is the most pressing thing from their perspective regarding food in the city?
Well, it's the same thing that Bloomberg has been working on. I would say keep working on the food and health issue the way Bloomberg has done it, but try to do a somewhat better job of bringing in... try not to drop it on people. Try to get people organized around the issues. But certainly the issues themselves were prominent. The health department commissioner is fantastic. I hope they keep him on. And so on the health side, it's very clear what needs to be done. And every single thing that Bloomberg did, there's now some evidence that it would do some good.
So we're talking salt, we're talking calories on menus.
All of those things. There's now some evidence that at least for some portion of the population, they do some good. And there was every reason to believe that the soda cap would do a great deal of good also. So that's on the food and health side. On the food and the system side, there could be a much, much stronger effort to try to get local farmers, meaning farmers within 50 or 100 miles, to sell their food in New York instead of having to source so much of New York's food at such great distances. So food system issues that a lot of groups are working on. And then the big one is food insecurity. Mm. That's still the big issue when there are more than a million New Yorkers who don't have enough to eat, and Congress is out to cut food stamps in every way it can. And food stamps are the last piece of the safety net left. The mayor really has to figure out some way to support whatever the Department of Agriculture is doing to help poor people.
Hmm. No small order, really, in some ways, especially,
it's huge.
Yeah, even in the biggest city, we're still just one city in a large country with a lot of differing opinions. Many of them represented in the cartoons in your book. When you've just finished a revision of food politics.
Yeah, it's out.
It's out. Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me.
It's out.
I read this one instead for anticipation. Never mind. Do people need to understand how these things work in order to make change or to affect change in their own lives? What can people do? Just people who are not passionate members of the food movement, maybe not even foodies, but to improve their own food selections, to sort of vote with your fork, as you say at the back of this book. What's the take home for the non-food obsessed person or the member not of the food movement?
Well, I guess the example that I like to give is that if you buy something at a farmer's market, you're helping a farmer to survive. And you're getting a food that's fresh and hasn't traveled so far and maybe really delicious. And so that's something that individuals can do without being political, without getting involved in political activity, and without doing anything other than spending a little bit more money than they might spend in a supermarket, but getting value for that money. The mere act of buying food at a supermarket, at a farmer's market, means that you are supporting the farmer who grew that food. So it's making that kind of connection between individual personal acts and the food system as a whole. And that's an easy sell to a lot of people. Getting people to grow food in their backyard is an easy sell once they figure out how to do it. It's really pretty easy. There are lots of things that are very easy entry points into making small changes that will have a big impact on the system as a whole. I mean, in a sense, that's what I'm hoping this book is going to do. It's an easy entry point into food politics. You know, you don't want to take a great big 500-page book with footnotes, millions of footnotes, and afterwards and appendices and all of this kind of academic apparatus. You can pick up this and look at the cartoons and kind of get it, if you want to. If you want to. And so I'm hoping to reach larger and larger audiences and to push the issue that if you want to make real political change, it's not enough to do that. There you have to join groups. You have to get involved in the political process. I wish we could get some foodies running for office or figure out some way to pay them to run for office the way our horrible political system works.
we'll make a quote, a pull quote out of that statement. So, and last time you were here, you mentioned that you were talking about Why Calories Count, which was a book, as you said, that was I guess would challenge some people who are trying to find all different reasons for why we eat and gain weight and do all that sort of stuff. And I just wondered if you could update us a little bit since that book came out on some of the new things we keep reading about all these other pursuits of reasons for being overweight. And it all seems so complicated. And I know that your constant refrain is it is also simple and we haven't actually changed what we've known for a very long time. I just wonder if you could update us a little bit on what people are hearing and how that reconciles with that book.
Yeah, I mean, the big issue is still, is it calories that count or is it where the calories come from? That's still where the arguments are. I think the physiology shows that it's the calories that count. The body couldn't care less where they came from. That's still heavily debated, and the journalist Gary Taubes has founded a scientific organization that's going to test the hypothesis. I hope he does a good job, and I hope they test it in a way that will actually answer the question. I always worry about that because funded studies often are designed in ways to give the funder the answer that the funder wants. And so I'm a little worried about that, but he has a very good group of scientists working with him, and I'm hoping that he'll get an answer to it. The other big issue that we wrote about.
Right.
The other big issue that has come up since, just in the last year, that we didn't write about was the microbiome. And we debated writing about the microbiome. We were starting to see these are the bacteria that live in your gut. And the hypothesis is that if you've got bacteria in your gut that digest anything that you get rid of, that's going to add more calories into your body. That's an explanation for obesity. I think, yes, there are bacteria that do that, but the calories aren't going to be great enough to make a difference. People don't overeat 10 or 20 or 50 calories a day. They're overeating hundreds of calories a day. And I don't think it can account for that. So we debated. The results were preliminary. There wasn't much stuff about it. We decided not to. I wish now that we had done a Q&A at the end and just said it's an interesting hypothesis, more research needs to be done, but we didn't. Mm-hmm. And now tons of stuff are coming out. I'm still not convinced that it makes any difference, but everybody loves it.
Well, I have to say, recently we were at the Dutchess County Fair and we saw giant piles of fried everything, potatoes, chips, fruit, I mean, fried Twinkies, everything. And I had a giant pile of said potato chips in my hand and said, I don't think it's a gene. I just don't think it's a gene. I don't think it's a microbe. I think it's this pile of potatoes and mayonnaise.
Potatoes has 1,400 calories.
I can't even imagine. And they had sold 27,000 milkshakes last year, and we're trying to top 30,000 this year. So, I mean, I don't know what the stats are on BMI in Dutchess County. We were certainly enthralled by the milkshakes, but yeah, I'm not sure it's the bacteria. I don't know.
I don't think it's the bacteria. And, you know, I mean, the estimations that have been done on how many calories a day you have to reduce in order to lose weight suggests that it's on the order of 300 calories a day. And the same kind of number is what people are increasing in order to gain weight. If you eat 300 calories extra a day over a period of a year, you'll gain some weight. Obviously, some people don't gain weight under those circumstances, but they're lucky.
Right.
Most of us do.
Yes, most of us present do, too. Even fewer, perhaps. Okay, well, if new research shows that there's something else to talk about, I hope that you'll come back and share your opinions with our audience. It's always a pleasure to be able to talk with you, someone who has not just the attitude of a food lover, but the expertise and knowledge of a scientist is someone who's rare to find. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Next week, this was actually our 99th show, and next week for our centennial, we are going to welcome back some of the guest hosts who we've had over the last couple of years. Isabella Wojcik, the program director of the James Beard Foundation, and Karen Karp, who is our partner in the annual James Beard Foundation Food Conference. We're going to talk about what we've learned talking to so many wonderful people over the course of 2 years and where we're going to go. I hope you'll join us. In the meantime, eat, drink, and vote. Bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.